Good morning, and welcome to the September 29th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on a beautiful fall day here in Old Town Park City.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone. Park City, Heber Valley, all across Summit and Wasatch counties. How's everyone doing?
Okay, so we've got a pretty interesting show coming up today. We're going to start by speaking with Keith Eig and Scott Greenberg. The topic of that conversation is long-term care insurance. How do you sort of provide for the potential that one will need long-term care, which can be expensive and can actually last quite a few months?
Yeah, and then next up, we have Corey Dutton from High West Lending, and she is a hard money lender, and it's not necessarily for those who can't get a loan from a bank. It's more for those who need a loan quickly, whether it's a remodel, a refinance. Fantastic conversation.
And then we're going to finish our hour by speaking with Haley Eckstein. She is the chef and founder of Sushi Ventures. She'll talk about, you know, how she brings a sushi party into your home.
Yeah, you don't have to go out for sushi. I mean, it comes to you. How fantastic is that?
All this and more will be right back after this.
Perhaps you've heard the term long-term care and thought it's pretty self-explanatory. Maybe you even thought, hey, I have good health insurance. That'll cover it. Or I'll be on Medicare by the time I need it. So I'm good. If any of that rings a bell, you may want to stop what you're doing for a few minutes and listen closely, as this may be very important to you, your loved ones, and maybe your life savings. On a personal note, I'm very fortunate that my mother and father had long-term care coverage. My mom had to be in a memory care unit at a senior care facility, running up big bills for the final 13 months of her life. My parents' retirement savings could have covered it, but that would have left my dad with almost nothing for his retirement, so long-term care is for the survivor or survivors. Lots has changed in the last 20 years since my parents got their long-term care coverage policy, and to help us learn all about it, we are fortunate to have Keith Eig and our very own host of Cool Science Radio, Scott Greenberg. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Keith, did
Great
I get
to be here, Kevin?
Did I get the last name pronounced correctly?
You did.
Okay, so LTC, long-term care. What is it exactly? Did I cover it well?
Yes, you did. But before I tell you what it is, we need to tell you what it's not.
Good.
It's not health insurance. It's not medical insurance. It's a big misconception. Long-term care is assistance you need when you're a serious illness or disability renders you unable to perform physically or cognitively two or more of the activities of daily living. Assistance is not limited to nursing homes, which a lot of people think the long-term care. Assistance is delivered in a variety of settings, in your own home, in a nursing home, or any of the levels of care in between. That's what it is. It helps you get assistance for the activities of daily living. And maybe we should talk what those are right now, just to let them know. There are six activities of daily living that just about all policies use. Bathing and eating are two of the more common ones. Dressing, toileting, continence, and transferring. Toileting and continence are self-explanatory. Transferring is the ability to get in and out of a chair or a bed. Bathing and eating are two of the first to go. And this can just be standby assistance. You could sort of take a shower, but you're wobbly in there. You need someone there watching you. That qualifies. And if you don't need help with any of those activities of daily living, you will qualify if you have cognitive impairment, specifically including memory loss, Alzheimer's, dementia, and things like that. So that's where long-term care insurance is.
So it covers the expenses that health insurance or Medicare will not cover.
Correct. Maybe we'll talk about who pays for what. There's a lot of misconceptions there. I'm glad you went there. Traditional Medicare does not pay for it. It has very limited coverage. Health insurance does not pay for long-term care. Medicaid will, but Medicaid is you have to exhaust all of your assets, and Medicaid only pays for a nursing home. It doesn't pay for any home health care. That's something none of us want our friends, families, or clients to deal with.
Not at all. So exactly.
Right? And the Medicare does have some coverage, but it's very limited. Generally speaking, if you go from a hospital directly to a nursing home, Medicare will pay the first 20 days of that. And then they have a formula that they could pay for up to another 80 days, depending on how you're doing. There's a sliding scale there. So what pays for it is out of your pocket or long-term care insurance. Those are basically the two plans that you can make to take care of this.
So who needs it? Does everybody need it? I mean, is this what everyone should get, or is there a certain percentage of the population?
Half of those listening will need it.
Oh.
Generally speaking, about two-thirds of women use long-term care insurance, about a third of men. Most of these claims come after age 70, although it can happen at any time. You mentioned with your personal situation how if you didn't have long-term care insurance, your dad's retirement assets would have been drained, and that would have been disastrous. You had a plan. If you didn't have a plan, that's your plan, no plan. And you can see the impact on family members and friends, and that's not good. So you should have a plan. I have a personal story, too. I sold my parents' long-term care insurance in the 1990s. It was pretty new then. We'll talk about the history of this product. In 2001, my dad went out and was on claim for 9.5 years with a dementia claim. Back then, you could buy lifetime benefits. Those don't really exist anymore. So we had, my parents lived in a two-story townhouse. The long-term care insurance policy paid for the little chairlift to go, so the steps were not an issue. They were go upstairs and that with this chair. It also paid for a full-time live-in. And we were very fortunate that we hired a woman one day, and 9.5 years later, she was still living in my parents' house. I mean, we found the right person right away, and that changed the lifestyle for my parents. My mom went on claim towards the end of it for other reasons, and they both passed away in 2010. But for 9.5 years, we had one and sometimes two aides in the house, one living there all the time. So that's the story you like to tell. My brothers love me, by the way.
Because you got them the policy and no one had to open up their wallets.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. One more thing.
Yep.
I told you I'm in Pittsburgh today visiting my mother-in-law, who is 90, for her permission to share this story. They never bought policies. Her husband passed away 5 years ago. Coincidentally, towards the end of his life, the woman that lived with my parents for 10 years was up here living with him for, 6 months. But fortunately, my mother-in-law has the resources. She has help come in every day. She doesn't need 24/7, but she has help come in every day. And fortunately, she has the resources. We all have personal stories. In fact, most people that ask us about long-term care insurance are doing so because of a recent situation with a family member or a friend. They're, oh my God, let's look into this now.
Yeah, so you had just mentioned that your parents, you got them a lifetime coverage. So that doesn't exist anymore. Can somebody, let's say your dad had a policy that wasn't lifetime coverage, could he have exhausted his long-term care coverage?
Of course. Most claims are 3 to 4 years. So that, we sell lots of policies. People look at 4-year plans, 6-year plans. Life doesn't come with a roadmap or an instruction book. You don't know how this is going to go. But if you can transfer the risk to someone else through insurance, you should, if you can afford to do that.
So let's break it down a little bit in terms of the nature of the product. You mentioned 3 years, 4 years. We talked about the scope of the type of coverage that would be done. Do most policies now, they have a limitation in terms of time, or would they also have, a limitation in terms of total dollar amount? Is it one, both, or is it one or both?
It's total dollar amount for the most cases.
Okay, so it's not done
for instance.
Okay, and what kinds of levels of dollar amounts are you typically seeing in policy? I'm sure there's a wide range.
If someone wanted to look at a policy, we would show them a policy that start with a beginning benefit, and they're usually done either by daily benefits or monthly benefits, $200 a day or $6,000 a month, and we would use that. Use a benefit period of, we'll show them 4 years or 6 years of benefits. So that gives them choices. That's what we're looking at. The other features of a policy, it's not just the daily benefit amount or the benefit period, it's the inflation rider. People that are on the younger side buying this need to buy an inflation protection rider on this thing, because it just, as with anything else.
And are policies of this type underwritten based on existing health, or are they anyone gets the same prices of the same age?
They are all medically underwritten. And for the most part, it's not invasive like a life insurance medical underwriting exam may be, but they all medically underwriting. Sometimes as simple as a form. Sometimes medical records are needed. Sometimes they do cognitive interviews on people. They are medically underwritten.
And do they tend to be level premium, or do they tend, or can premiums based as you age?
Well, we're going to open a can of worms here. If you don't mind, let me briefly tell you the three types of policies, because then your question becomes more appropriate. type of life insurance, long-term care insurance that Kevin's parents own, that I own, Scott Greenberg owns. We call it traditional long-term care insurance, where you pay a premium each year and you have your coverage. The premium can be affordable, and you can really design these policies any way you want. But those policies, what we call traditional or standalone, represent maybe 10% of the market today. And the reason is, I think you alluded to, premium increases. These policies were not guaranteed. Most clients don't remember that. So we deal with issues all the time. I thought this was the premium forever. You know, they sign off, they understand. And the premium increases have been dramatic in cases and very uncomfortable. So clients have to decide, keep the policy, pay the increase, or shave some benefits and, you know, do some, you know, changing of benefits to keep the premium lower. Now, a word on premium increases. The company just can't do it. I mean, they have to, in the policies, the language says, listen, we can go to the commissioner and ask of the state that we sold this policy in and request a premium increase. We have to open our books, show them how we miscalculated the claims or the interest earnings or the lapse ratios and all those things. And then and I'll just make up numbers, but this will show you what happens out there in the real world. An insurance company go to the commissioner, look at this. We sold these policies from 2004 to 2007, this block, and here's the numbers. We need to raise the premium 72%. The insurance commissioner will say, oh, okay, you can do 15%. And the insurance companies, thank you, we'll be back next year. And they keep coming back until they get to their 70. That's pretty much how it works. So some clients just remember this and don't care and pay it, but most are upset about this. That's the main reason this policy type is one of the smallest sold now. Hybrids is the next type of policy. Premiums can never change in these. A hybrid is what we're seeing most people get involved with. It's technically a life insurance policy, but you're buying it for long-term care protection. And I'll just use some numbers to show you. Someone pays a lump sum of $100,000 into a policy. They immediately get like $400,000 of long-term care benefit, and that can grow with time with inflation. If they never use it, the $100,000 deposit all comes back to them, plus a little in the form of a death benefit. So people like these things. There's no use it or lose it. The first kind, if you didn't use it, you lost all those premiums. Mm-hmm. This way, the money at least comes back if you don't use it. And every premium is guaranteed. It can't be changed. These were typically sold with lump sum payments. But most insurance carriers that do this will let you spread them out, you know, 5, 10, even 20 years in some cases. And again, the premiums are guaranteed. The third kind of policy that we don't do a lot of, it's a life insurance policy with a long-term care rider. And that's just an advancement of the death benefit. Under certain conditions, if you qualify, you can start taking, it's usually 2 or 4% of the face amount on a monthly basis. And you can use that for long-term care. That's a whole nother conversation we're not going to get into, because there's critical care riders, long-term care riders, and they're all a little different on these policies and underwritten and priced differently. And there are not a lot of them. You know, just someone, I need life insurance, but I wouldn't mind using some of that for long-term care would fit in that case. You can never get inflation on those kinds of policies, and that's another reason they're not that popular. So you asked me about premium increases, and I did a lot of talking. Where are we now?
We're still on it. So let's take a 60-year-old male, for instance, and what would they need for a dollar amount for their long-term care?
How much benefit they would need?
Yeah, on average.
Well, again, in today's dollars, we use $6,000 a month of benefit is okay. A good benefit. And we always inflate that. And, you know, a 60-year-old will buy that. And when he's 80, 85, when he may more likely be on claim, that $6,000 a month is going to be $15,000 a month.
And if I'm looking at Category 1, 60-year-old man, good-looking guy like Greenberg walks in, wants to get a policy that pays $6,000 a month for 50 months, right? Which is, a $300,000 max. What order of magnitude premium would you be looking at now?
For a couple, a man and the wife, probably $5,000 to $10,000 total all in for the two of them. Oh. And that's an annual premium that will go up when the insurance company decides they have to raise the premiums.
And that is probably the modal kind of policy that we'd be looking at? In other words, is that the typical product you're selling now?
that's the typical benefits we're selling, but we're not selling those annual premiums because people don't want to see those premiums go up. They're retired on a fixed income, and this $10,000 they used to pay is now $20,000 a year.
So the life insurance type policy, category two you mentioned, what kind of lump sum premium would I be looking at, or which, as you mentioned, could be spread out over time?
$100,000-ish is usually where it is.
Yeah. Gotcha. And so
we just did one. You know, they change. It's every state and every benefit is different. But we just did one yesterday. This person was young. I want to say they were like 47 or 48, but interested. And their premium was like at mid 80s, $85,000 for the lump sum to buy, you know, the rich benefit that we've been talking about.
And Keith, this is Scott. We just actually had a client here in Park City, a woman, 62 years old. She bought $6,000 a month benefit with the inflation rider, and her lump sum was exactly $112,000. So,
okay,
that was a good
guess. You're right in that ballpark. And again, it's, by the way, going to be based on gender. It is going to be based on state. Not all states have every insurance carrier admitted to that state for long-term care. For example, California can be a little picky on who they let in, and Utah has certain carriers that they allow in. So, you know, it's also state-based as well.
So Keith and Scott are partners in the business. Keith is back east, and Scott is here in Park City and can easily be reached. We'll have contact information after this, but still have a lot of questions on this. I know there's a couple of different plans, indemnity and reimbursement. Can you explain the difference between those two, please?
Yeah. That refers to how the benefit gets paid. Reimbursement is just what it says. Let's just use simple numbers, $200 a day. And you go out on claim and you spend $180 a day on your help. They'll reimburse you $180 up to the $200. If you spend $210, they'll give you $200. You spend the $10. That's reimbursement. Indemnity is if you have a $200 a day or $6,000 a month benefit and you qualify for claims at the beginning of each month, the insurance company gives you $6,000 and you go buy your care any way you want. You're not producing receipts. You don't have to show. You have to, you know, qualify for the care medically. You have to have the doctor's reports for that. And then you go out and spend the care. Now, I don't know how to answer the question I'm going to ask myself is, what happens, let's say they give you $6,000, you only spend $4,000 on care that month. I think the other $2,000 could be taxable. I don't know. It's never come up. So make sure if you're on an indemnity plan, you spend all your money.
Find somebody there.
And a note on and a comment on reimbursement. It's not like you're gathering receipts and mailing them in and waiting for a check, you know, paying. With my parents, you know, this was 15, 20 years ago, we had an agency provide the woman that lived there, and we just assigned everything to the agency. They sent the bills right to the insurance company. Every 2 weeks, they got paid. We never wrote a check or did anything other than get copies. Home health care providers love that. You know, they love it when you have insurance. They love it. They say, yeah, we'll just file the claim for you. So while that's a reimbursement plan, it sort of operated where you didn't have to get involved with anything, writing checks or doing anything.
Yeah, you just answered my next question. You know, how does one put in, you know, how does one qualify for the benefits? And you just covered that. I know there's been a lot of chatter lately about health insurance companies denying claims. Is that happening with long-term care? I mean, once you hit two of those six explanations that you mentioned early on, you should be qualified.
Or none of those six in cognitive impairment. I would imagine we've been doing this a lot for like almost, you know, 30 years now. And probably had 40 claims. One time it wasn't approved. One time. And because the doctor's report basically didn't say they qualified. The family kept complaining that they needed it, but it wasn't medically necessary. And Scott knows who I'm talking about, but it's the only time in our history that a claim wasn't approved. So claim time has gone very well for us. You know, once your doctor signs off that you need this help, that's pretty. And they can come out and check once or twice a year, the insurance company can, I mean, just to make sure you still qualify for claim, they usually don't. They get medical records if they want to see.
Scott, anything else you want to add to this information?
Just that I cannot tell you how much I appreciate Keith's knowledge as a partner. He's amazing. And the hybrid policies, these long-term care hybrid policies, absolutely the way to go. As Keith mentioned, I have a standalone policy that my wife and I got 15 years ago. And unfortunately, great carrier, by the way. We love the carrier, love the coverage. We had very, very rich benefits. But our premium has gone up 60% over the last 15 years. And, you know, it's just, maybe it's still a good deal, but getting those premium notice increases, boy, it just really sticks in your throat. So, you know, be careful when you are buying these policies. Talk to an insurance professional like Keith. Explore all your options, and you'll be in good shape.
Gotcha. But they can also talk to you, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm here.
And Scott, don't blame your agent for that policy.
Exactly.
So, thanks, Keith.
So most people are doing a lump sum single payment. Now, do you find people...
Yeah, or spreading it out over a few years, but yes, okay, they're going in that route.
So if someone doesn't have, let's say, $112,000 sitting around, but they have it in their IRA, and they are over 59 and a half where they can take it out without penalty, do they do that?
They can.
They can, but have you known anyone who's
well,
done
it? Well, I mean, it's like in your case, you don't want to deplete retirement assets for other reasons. And
of course.
That's what that would be doing.
That's what I would, yeah.
I mean, if you have enough in there that's not going to put a big dent in it, sure.
Perfect. Okay, we just spent a few minutes with Keith Eig and Scott Greenberg talking about long-term care. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
And we'll
thank you so much. And if you have any questions, follow up with Scott or me, and we can make up answers for you.
Fantastic. Stay with us. We'll be right back. In 2008, in the middle of the financial crisis, High West Lending was founded. At that time, banks were not giving loans and some were having difficulty staying open. Our next guest saw opportunity amid the turmoil and is now the go-to choice for private money lending. We're fortunate to welcome Corey Dutton to the show. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Nice to be here with you guys.
Awesome. Hey, so can you please tell us, what are private money loans and trust deed investments?
So in a nutshell, you've got bank financing, you've got loans from banks and credit unions primarily, and then you've got shadow banking, which is frequently called in Europe, right? Those are private money loans, typically using real estate as collateral. Now, trust deed investments, how are they different? Same thing. We're still talking about private money loans. However, depending on the state in which you're doing these private money loans in, some states are trust deed states. So when you do a mortgage on a property, it's either called a mortgage or it's called a trust deed, depending on the state. So in Utah, we're a trust deed state, so that's where you get the term trust deed investments.
Perfect. And private money lending is exactly that. It's private money that you've raised and you loan. And is it mostly real estate you're doing?
Yep, it's all real estate. Real estate is the collateral for the loans, yes.
Gotcha. So you write loans, and you also gather up investors who will give you a bankroll that you can then loan. I like that idea. So people don't have to go to a bank.
That's correct. Because as you know, banks, you know, if you've gone for a bank loan recently, it can take months, you know. And when you have a good real estate opportunity, it's not going to wait months. You need to be able to close on that pretty quickly, usually within a week or two. And so that's the benefit and the difference primarily between the type of loan that I do and a bank loan.
So there are a couple of differences I'm sensing. One is speed, and one is sort of the nature of the underwriting process. And those two are obviously very well related. Talk to us a little bit about how and why what you do from an underwriting perspective differs from what a bank does.
So really, you know, the majority of the borrowers that we lend money to are bankable. You know, they have good credit, they have good income, good financial assets, but it's sort of like you hinted to, you know, the speed is an aspect of it. So really our underwriting, the only way that it really differs is that it's a lot faster, right?
And the way you build an institution, to sort of go on what Kevin said, you know, we think of banks are, there's a series of depositors that create a pool of capital from which they can make their loans. You're obviously a much smaller private operation, so you basically gather up a series of private investors who create is it a partnership or a corporation that then turns around and lends out the money?
So mine is a little bit different. So there's two types of funds. You have a typical debt fund where you just wire your money to this fund and then they give you an annual rate of return. You have no control over which assets that you're lending on, essentially. You have no clue. You're just getting a check every month, essentially, for that rate of return that you've agreed to. We're structured a little differently. So we're very boutique. We're very one-on-one with our investors. And so initially, it's very active in the sense that the investor gets to choose which asset.
Oh, wow.
Right, that he or she wants to lend their money on. And so it's very individualized. But once that loan is placed, then it becomes passive. They just kick back, they get a check every month and until that loan pays off, and then they get their principal back. So it's essentially an interest-only loan. They're getting an interest payment every month, sort of like what you pay to the bank, except no principal. And then at the end of that loan term, they get the principal back in a balloon payment.
And how long is the loan term generally? I mean, is the interest rate a little bit higher with you because it's fast? So therefore they will go and take the time and get a new mortgage and pay it off fairly quick?
Correct. So that's where that term bridge loans mm-hmm. comes from. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are familiar with that term, right? So it's a bridge between now and a future event, whether that would be a refinance with your bank at a later date or a sale potentially, or possibly maybe another equity injection where you're going to sell another property, take that equity from that property, bring it in and pay that loan off. So it is definitely a higher interest rate. You know, you're paying 10 to 12% annually for a loan like this, right? And you're paying for the speed, like you said.
So if I was a house flipper, this is exactly what I need.
Absolutely. Yep. And all different types. I mean, we lend to individuals as well. So not just real estate investors. We have people that might be relocating for example, from Florida to Park City, right? And they've got to sell a couple of assets in Florida before they can buy that house in Park City with cash. But a lot of time they have a significant amount of cash, so 50% or more. And so we do a trust deed in a first position, a first mortgage, until they sell those assets in Florida, hypothetically speaking, right? And then they pay the loan off, usually within a 6-month period. A lot of our loans are 3 to 6 months in term.
And how would you break down, what's the breakdown of the nature of your borrowers in terms of sort of professional real estate developers, individuals, and sort of other?
That's a good question. Let me think about that for a second. So I would say probably 50% is going to be real estate investors that are looking to take advantage of opportunities, right? And then the other 50% is broken down into, I would say, about 25% individuals, like the example I just gave of the couple moving from Florida to Park City. And then the other 25% would be business owners. A lot of business owners have these assets, real estate assets that are owned free and clear or have very little debt on them, and they want capital for inventory purchases to fund, capital investments in their business. And so about 25% of our loans come from business owners.
Now, so how does that work? So if I owned a property and I needed to raise money for my business, I would mortgage it through you to get capital.
Yep.
To then invest into my business.
Absolutely.
Well, that's genius.
Yes, it's great. It's because, banks don't do cash out refinances very easily. It's extremely difficult, especially if you own a property free and clear without any debt on it. It doesn't matter how good your credit is. It doesn't matter how good your income is. It is very difficult to pull that cash out. And it's very expensive. Typically, if you're going to get a cash out refinance loan from a bank, you're going to pay sometimes 2 percentage points higher for that money than you would for just refinancing the existing debt.
So even if I wanted to remodel, if we have listeners out there say, hey, I own my house, I've had it for enough years, it needs some work, and they want to make it bigger, remodel, whatever, they can cash out with you.
Yes, it's so much easier to do that because let's say you wanted to do a $50,000 remodel, right? And I came in and I did a bridge loan on that and gave you that $50,000 to do it. Well, now it's not a cash out refinance. So now when that's done, you can go back to your bank, get an appraisal, and now you're not doing a cash out refinance. You're just paying off existing debt that I gave you.
So that's the beauty of the bridge, is that I was sitting here trying to think, okay, why would I do that? Okay, why would I like to do a remodel? I got a short-term loan. Where am I going to get the cash to pay that back?
Right.
And the answer is that by doing the improvement, it's the appraisal that allows me to do a refinance that isn't cashed out, right?
Right.
Except to the extent of paying you off.
Right. And another example that is pretty frequent with us is, let's say you're selling a home. You know, a lot of people out there, unfortunately, they do not have these cash reserves sitting there. So when they go to sell their house, if the inspection finds something, you know, like it needs a new roof, or there was flooding in the basement and we need to do some mitigation and we need to repair the damage from that flooding. A lot of people don't even have $10,000 in their bank that they could cover something big like that. So what happens is in essence, when you're selling a property, if you've got, let's say, a $10,000 problem, that $10,000 problem can cost you $50,000 to $100,000 on your purchase price or sales price of that property, right? And so we do a lot of that too, where realtors will call us and say, inspector found this, they don't have the $30,000, we need you to come in and fix this. And we get paid pretty well for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So someone could just take out a loan for $30,000 to do that work. They pay the interest, but then they save so much because it's not going to cost them on the closing.
And they pay it off at closing.
Yeah.
Well, the issue is, though, once you've listed a property for sale, a lot of people don't know this. If you list a property for sale, you cannot get a loan against that property.
You can't get a mortgage.
You can't get a HELOC or a regular refinance, because the bank wants you to have that money for a period of time so they can get their interest, right? Whereas with us, you know, it's an interest-only loan. It's short-term basis. We're turning that money over and over so quickly. So to us, it's really not a matter of trying to keep that loan as long as possible. We really would like to get paid back as quick as possible.
So you've been around 17 years, since 2008, as we mentioned. In those 17 years, do you have a dollar value of what you have loaned out?
Yes, definitely. I'm very proud of it. So over $550 million in loans I've done since that time. Now, compared to some of these large debt funds, that is just nothing. That's like 2 or 3 years, you know, right? And So that's over 17 years. But I'm pretty proud of that, because we're a super small boutique company. We're a lifestyle company. We keep it small. We keep it real. We really try to live our lives and enjoy our lives first and put that first. And then the work comes second. And so I'm pretty proud of that, because I've been able to live a pretty good life out here in Park City.
Yeah. And are you just here in Park City or say Summit County, the whole Wasatch back?
I lived in Park City up until about 10 years ago, and then we moved out to the Camas Valley. So now we live in Francis, which I love.
And what was your background? How did you end up in this business?
Okay, great. So I got my MBA with a focus on international business, and I thought that that's what I was going to do. I moved to Utah because I wanted to, you know, snowboard. I wanted to mountain bike. I wanted to be living in the outdoors, camping and doing all that stuff. So I said, where can I live in the mountains and work in the city? Because I knew I was going to have to get a job with a big corporation. And sure enough, I discovered Salt Lake City and Park City, how close it is to this big city. And so I purchased a home in Summit Park, up at Parley Summit, so I could be close to the downtown. And I got a job with a small hedge fund in Salt Lake City. One of the asset classes that they ironically invested in was trust deed investing. They did quite a bit of that. And so I learned that from them. And then I went and worked for a mortgage company during the financial crisis. The hedge fund sort of folded. Mm. And during the financial crisis, I had a mortgage company that recruited me to help them do marketing. And that's how I learned the mortgage side of things. They also folded, unfortunately. Yes. And so I started Private Money Utah, which was the original company before High West Lending, and ran with it. And I've been running with it ever since, because banks, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, were locked up at that time. As we know, many of them closed their doors. So I started out actually doing foreclosures. I got a bunch of investors and we put some money together, and we started lending money on these foreclosures. And that's kind of how I got started with it.
All right. So since you mentioned outdoors, I understand you were behind the creation of the Slate Creek Trail out in the Uintas. Tell us more about that. What's the organization you're working with on that?
Definitely. Many listeners have probably heard of the Slate Creek Mountain Bike Trail up in the Uintas, trying to get out of the busy Park City mountain bike trails up here, and have discovered it. It's about 4 years old. The South Summit Trails Foundation is a small trails foundation, very similar to Mountain Trails Foundation in Park City. It's been around since 2016. I am the president of the South Summit Trails Foundation. So that's what I do in my free time. You know, I build trails out in South Summit County. One of the things I discovered when I moved out to Francis in the Camas Valley is there's really not a lot of trails out there. So so I immediately sort of discovered that it was time to build trails out there. And so the Slate Creek Mountain Bike Trail was the brainchild of a bunch of individuals that founded the Trails Foundation, namely Tom Noker, which many people know that name in the community, Adam Brown, Howard Sorensen, Doug Evans. And $350,000 later, we have this trail. So I raised, primarily my function there was raising the money for that trail.
I want to go back to the lending business for a minute, and you know, right now we're in a period where the future of Fed funds rates is really uncertain. We don't know if they're going to continue to cut them. Talk to us a little bit about the interaction between, you know, what the Fed does and the interest rates you have to charge. How do those things link up?
So as we all know, or many of us know, the federal funds rate really doesn't as much dictate long-term mortgages. It's more the 10-year yield. As we saw last week, when the Fed lowered the interest rates by 25 basis points, the 10-year yield went up by 25 basis points.
Yeah, why does that make sense?
I personally think, well, but you know what's funny is all these theories and fundamentals, as we all know, right, we've been seeing, are sort of out the window in the last 5 to 7 years. So it's anybody's guess what's happening in the markets right now. In fact, the 10-year yield has gone down this past week again. So it's anybody's best guess. The way we price our loans is sort of, you know, 4 to 5% above the prime rate. Okay. So we try to kind of keep it in that range. So as interest rates go down, the long-term interest rates, our interest rates will also go down. And then as those go up, obviously, our interest rates go up.
We just talked about the 10-year. What happened to the prime rate? Did that move with the 10-year?
Good question. I should have checked that.
I'm not trying to stump you. I'm just you know, we hear all this, and there's so many, much in the news about the Fed's moves. And trying to translate that into people's everyday living is something that I struggle with.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, everybody. I think everybody's struggling right now to try to figure this stuff out, right? Because it's all the fundamentals, I feel like, that used to apply are sort of out the window. And it's really difficult to guess. You know, it used to be, I felt like you could predict things more based on fundamentals that we always went to, these rock hard fundamentals. And now it just seems like it's anybody's best guess every single day.
Yeah, the rates change on a whim.
It's a little disconcerting that someone with your degree of background has the same degree of uncertainty as Kevin and I do about this. But I suppose that speaks more to the way things are. 4 to 5 points above prime. Where is prime right now? So
prime has been hovering right around 7.5%.
Okay, so a short term loan would be in the 12s.
That's correct. So our interest rates are usually 10 to 12. Okay. And it usually is based on down payment size or equity.
Yes.
More than the credit score of the borrower or anything like that. Because most of our borrowers are bankable that come to us. We don't lend money to desperate people. We want an exit strategy, and we want a good plan, and we want financial strength from our borrowers. So we really don't deal with anyone with bad credit.
My last question is typical loan length.
Loan length, well, we do 12-month terms, but most of our loans are paid back within 6 months or less.
And how can our listeners get in touch with you if they want to take advantage of the private money loans? Are you looking for investors as well?
Definitely both. I'm always looking for investors. I don't need money right now. I've got plenty of money to put out there on the street, but I'm always looking for people that understand real estate and that are looking for a way to diversify their portfolio within real estate through the trust deeds. They can find me, both borrowers and potential lenders, at highwestlending.com. I'm also on Instagram, and it's corey.dutton.lender.
And that's Corey, CoreyDutton.
Chef Haley Eckstein is the proprietor of Sushi Venture, a local Park City sushi caterer. She will bring the sushi to you. Good morning, Haley, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you, Roger, for having me.
Okay, Haley, let's start. Can you share a bit about your background? I know you're a Park City local, and the path that led you to Sushi Venture.
All right, so born and raised in Park City, Utah. I grew up ski racing, playing lacrosse, and soccer. I also had a passion for art and food. My mom, my uncle, my grandmother, and a lot of other family members are very passionate about cooking, hobbyist chefs. And so when I was a young girl, my mom had me in the kitchen cooking with her. And that is what kind of inspired this whole culinary interest.
Well, this is not something that you go to college and you naturally find yourself as a sushi chef. Talk a little more about that path.
Sure. So attended Pitzer College in Claremont, California, and had the intent, I majored in human biology, had the intent of going to medical school, and then had the incredible opportunity my junior year of college to travel abroad to Italy. Of course, you're in food Mecca. So for my internship, I had the opportunity to shadow a food critic. And so he took me behind the scenes to Parmesan cheese factories, salami factories, gelato shops, coffee shops, chocolate shops, really small family-run mom-and-pop restaurants. And that completely shifted my mindset and wanted me to pursue something in the culinary field.
And did you wind up going to a culinary school?
Yes, I did. So fast forward a little bit. Graduated from college, moved back home, and started working in some restaurants in Park City. And fell into sushi when I started working at Flying Sumo on the bottom of Main Street. So that kind of cultivated my sushi journey and the starts of what I was going to pursue in that sort of realm.
Your website refers to the fact that you have a sensei.
Yes.
And who is that?
Sensei Andy Matsuda. So to answer your question, I ended up going to a 2-month sushi chef training school in Torrance, California.
Okay.
Called the Sushi Chef Institute. And my sensei, Andy Matsuda, led this program where he taught you all about Japanese history and cuisine, everything from sushi making to small appetizers, entrees, everything like that. He also would bring us to the fish market, the local fish market in Torrance, California. And we would really learn about how to pick out fish, how to break down the fish, how to prepare the fish, and then how to honor all of those traditional sushi making processes when it came to that cuisine.
You spent some time at Flying Sumo. What gives you the instinct to make the big jump into some kind of private catering business?
So after I graduated sushi chef school at the end of 2019, I actually got a job in Manhattan, New York. I worked for a really small 4-seat speakeasy omakase bar in Manhattan. It was on the 10th floor of a hotel building overlooking part of Times Square. And so this was kind of that next jump in the next chapter of learning about sushi, learning what it was like to be in a restaurant scene, but also Sushi by Boo, which was the restaurant in Manhattan, had a nod towards tradition, but also towards a flair of a new modern take on sushi. So that was that next jump that propelled me into wanting to delve into this world.
And this world is?
Omakase Sushi Catering.
And that's based here in Park City?
Yes.
And how long have you been in business?
So I started Sushi Venture at the end of 2020, and then really kind of took off in the beginning of 2021 in March when people started getting vaccinated and more comfortable sharing this experience with people and having people in their homes. What I do now is I take that kind of Sushi by Boo restaurant, speakeasy, omakase vibe, if you will, and bring it to people's homes. So it's a very traditional sushi omakase service where I work closely with distributors to sustainably source fish from around the world, primarily from Tokyo, from the Toyosu market in Japan. I fly in those fish whole. I break everything down from start to finish into saku blocks and or fillets, if you will. And then I bring those fillets and saku blocks to your house. And I set up a very traditional sushi bar experience where I make the sushi rolls, the nigiri, and sashimi right in front of you, and then I present it in a very artful and tasteful experience.
So let's go through it. A typical evening, you show up, you're probably in your white coat. Do you have your white hat?
Black chef's coat. I like to do black
chef's coat. Okay.
And then sometimes I'll wear a traditional kind of Japanese bandana. So I show up and, like I said, I show up with those saku blocks. And so for those who want to sit in the kitchen with me and really experience the process from start to finish, I will slice all the fish in home so they can watch that. And then those slices of fish will either be used for sushi rolls, nigiri, and or sashimi. So after I'm done slicing all the fish and preparing it and putting it into a netta case, I use this really traditional bamboo netta case that displays all the fish, so there's no large refrigeration system in front of your face. It's very quiet and elegant. I will slice all the fish, and then I will begin making sushi rolls and nigiri and sashimi. So I do sort of like a 2.5 course evening. I always start with nigiri and sashimi as it's the most pure way to taste all of the fish. I really like to highlight the quality and flavors of each fish that I fly in because I'm getting in the highest quality fish possible in Salt Lake City. And so the nigiri and sashimi really highlight those flavors. And then I'll proceed to sushi rolls as I mix and match all the fish combined, and I also add some cucumber, asparagus, avocado, so you get a little bit more flavor profile in the sushi rolls.
And do you talk about the different fish? Do you sort of explain, you know, what is this? Where does it come from? What kind of flavors does it have?
Yes. So once I plate everything and we sit down at the dining table, I will explicitly go through each fish that I have sourced and served and then the ingredients that I pair on top. That way everybody knows what they're enjoying and what they're eating. I also recommend an order in which I think you should eat the nigiri. You always start with the leanest fish and then work your way down towards your fattiest fish. That way your taste buds don't get overwhelmed. So I will explain that prior to everybody sitting down to eat.
Let's talk about, obviously you're telling us that you're getting the highest quality fish. Let's talk about how you organize your sourcing. How long has that taken? Do you have networks and how does it work?
Yes, I have a few distributors that I work with. My primary distributor is in Salt Lake. So I use him because it's really nice to be, one, the same state, two, I can have some face-to-face contact. Typical ordering, I need to know what to order about a week to 2 weeks in advance, 2 weeks really. If I'm going to order anything from Japan, so specialty fish, whether that's kinmedai, a goldeneye snapper, some specialty sea breams, halibut from Japan, uni from Japan, that needs 2+ weeks of ahead of time ordering.
So that sort of drives, from a business perspective, when people set up an evening with you, it really is at least a couple of weeks out.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
Yeah, let's say, for instance, I've got family coming between Christmas and New Year's.
Yes.
Do I book with you now? Because I imagine you're going to be slammed, or are you already full?
I am actually already full for the last week of December and into New Year's. So the sooner you can get me booked and get on the schedule, the better.
Nice.
I already have bookings all the way into March of 2026, which
Great.
Is incredible.
Let's go to April then. So I've got people come in April, right? And so do you send me a sample menu? And then I say, oh, yeah, we want that. We want some of that. Or do we just say, hey, you're the chef, bring it?
You say, hey, you're the chef, bring it.
Love it.
So I have two different tiers of service. I have my Sushi Venture Original, which I've got a nice, really elegant staple menu for that. And then I have my Grand Venture Experience, which is a next step up in the service. That I will fly in some crazy exotic specialty fish from around the world. So both of those experiences are available. And if you would like to book one and you know you have family coming in, I always highly recommend getting me on the calendar as soon as possible, especially for the months of December through April, is that's my busy time.
And how busy are you?
I'm very grateful. I'm very busy. From December through April, I am on average booked out 5 to 6 nights a week. And then come summertime, it is slower but still steady, about 2 to 3 times a week. And then sometimes in the fall, you get a little bit of a lull. So October, November gets a little bit slower, but it gives me the time to reset my mind and prepare for winter and get ready for another awesome season.
So when people want to have a nice Halloween sushi party instead of candy, they could book you right now, because that would
Absolutely.
Be a blast.
Actually, funny you said that. Literally 2 days ago, I just had a repeat client who I haven't seen in a little while. She reached out and said, hey, are you available for Halloween? And I said, yes.
Oh, good.
So we got a Halloween party for the books this year.
Do you have any employees?
I do not.
Now, so you're capacity constrained. Have you thought about trying to make this bigger with, you know, adding another chef?
I have thought about it multiple times, but at this moment in time, I'm going to stick with it just being me. Part of the experience is your interaction with me. So mm-hmm. that kind of makes the evening a little more special. So for the time being, one employee only.
And with one employee, how many people, what are the sizes of the groups that you can accommodate?
I do a minimum of 6 and a maximum of 12.
Oh, good.
So very small, intimate experiences. I like to be able to interact with the guests and form relationships with my clientele and also be able to talk to them throughout the evening and form those relationships and answer those questions appropriately. So anything bigger than that gets a little bit too much for one person.
And how long is the evening?
It varies based on how the pace in which people decide that they would like to eat. I have some clients that eat pretty quickly. I have some clients that like to take their time and eat really slow. You can expect anywhere from 45 minutes to a 2-hour experience.
Oh, okay.
And do you help people figure out what kind of sake to buy?
I do. Okay. I do. Okay. So I will give recommendations.
And can you? I tell you, you can buy that at the local liquor, Utah liquor
yes.
stores. They do have.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And you know, this is a business show. Tell us what the price points are.
Okay. So for the Sushi Venture Original, it's $185 per person, and then for the Grand Venture Experience, it is $265 per person.
Let's see. What else do we want to share with our guests? How can they get in touch with you to book?
You could have an Election Day sushi.
There you go.
There you go.
Okay. So how would they get, what's your website? How can people get a hold of you?
Yes, so it's sushiventure.com. And you can either call me at my phone number, 435-659-8889. And or you can email me at sushiventureinfo@gmail.com.
We've been speaking with Haley Eckstein of Sushi Venture. She did not bring us samples, but we've had a wonderful time. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this.